was, the theme is we need many lines of evidence. There's not many in dark energy, but there's more than one. And the short version of it was the evidence for the universe accelerating said that something had to have p plus rho is negative, p plus 3 rho, rho plus 3p had to be negative. And that was in the picture where you assume that dark that the contribution that's got negative rho plus 3p is one for which w is equal to minus 1, and rho is positive, but p is minus rho, you're led to a statement that the energy density that you need versus the amount of non-relativistic stuff you need has to live in some region, and it has to have non-zero accelerating material, or dark energy. And then that was consistent with measurements of the flatness of the universe coming from the CMB, which was the dotted line. When you combine the CMB with the measured value of the Hubble scale, it tells you you have to be around here somewhere on this line. And then the measurements that dark matter for the dark matter abundance were consistent, and they were telling you kind of where you were here. And the nice thing is that they all come together in the same place. So any of those three things, you can throw away one of them, and you're still being led to the same place. And so you have a sense that there's a certain amount of robustness there that if somebody completely were to screw up one of these measurements, then the other two are telling you the same message. And so going back to the question, specifically the supernova evidence, you remember there was an issue there that if you're looking back, if this is time and that's space, you're looking back along the past light cone, and you're asking how things that are sending you light are, how their distance compares to the redshift, and there was a degeneracy there that the story I told you was about things changing in time, and we had dark energy making things accelerate, but you could have equally well imagined that there was something happening in the space directions, and you had an inhomogeneous cosmology, and that can describe the supernova part of it. But when you're assessing things like that, it's the comparison to the other things. I mentioned the issue of isotropy, and you have to be in the center of the void, which you could be. But you have to then have to also ask, to what extent is that accounting for the flatness of the universe evidence? And in the dark energy case, because there's only really three lines, it's not such a compelling argument either way. But it's when you're assessing things, those are the things that the utility of having more than one piece of evidence is that it gives you some criterion to start judging different approaches. So the message from that is, if you're an observer, there's no problem with dark energy. Dark energy, you know, Occam's razor wins here, because if you're just doing general relativity and you want to explain the acceleration of the universe, there's a picture where you have this pie chart where there's a certain amount of baryons, and you know they're there because of nucleosynthesis and also their effects on the microwave background. There's a certain amount of dark matter, and you know it's there because of all the evidence from galaxies and clusters of galaxies and the microwave background and structure formation. And there's a bunch of dark energy, and it has to be there to make the universe accelerate. That was kind of a surprise at first, but the vacuum, which you know exists, is Lorentz invariant, and it could very well have an energy, and the only way you'd tell is it would gravitate, and if it gravitated, it would do this. And so the measurements of the CMB can constrain experimentally the value of W, and they basically show you that W is less than or of the order of minus 0.9 or something like that. So it had to be less than minus a third to accelerate, and it's consistent with minus 1. It actually allows you to have it be a little bit less than minus 1. I can't remember what the other side of the limit is, but there's a range that's allowed, and the observations just completely nail W equals minus, but W equals minus 1 nails the observations, and rho, which you remember, you're effectively, if you can measure the Hubble scale, you're measuring rho. It's the fact that the universe is flat at spatial slices, the evidence for that coming from the CMB is telling you essentially the value of rho, and it's the critical rho. So rho is essentially rho critical, and since that's mostly dark energy now, that's the dark energy density, and that's basically 10 to the minus 29 grams per cubic centimeter. If you're an astronomer, those are the units you use. But in an EV, that would be, if you use fundamental units, h bar equals c equals 1, then the dark energy is basically the critical density, and that's something like 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth power. It's an energy divided by a length cubed, so that's energy to the fourth if you're using h bar equals c equals 1, and that's kind of where that comes from. So from the point of view of an observer, they would say, you know, what's the problem? And they might be right, because the thing is, the simplest thing you could think of does what you want, and you can make more complicated models of dark energy, and people do. And if you're making classical models, they're always more complicated than the vacuum energy, and they, for the most part, don't. It's not like there's no observational problem with the vacuum being the source of dark energy. All the problems with dark energy are really theoretical problems, and so when you're if you get into the business of trying to explain dark energy, be aware of that it's because they're theoretical problems. When you're ranking problems with experiment are kind of in your face. Problems with theory, you have to always ask, is the problem because we're thinking about it wrong, rather than it's just a disagreement with nature. So I give you that as a warning, because I'm going to tell you the party line as to what the biggest problem is. And the worry is always that it's a theoretical argument, and so it's a pretty good argument, but it's in the end of the day, it's an argument. So the problem with dark energy, so the thought was that a vacuum, Lorentz invariant vacuum energy, and that's kind of one of those sentences that needs punctuation. So the energy of a Lorentz invariant vacuum predicts W equals minus 1 and agrees well with the observations. You know, other things you could say, what else could you have done? We talked about if you had a scalar field. So, you know, there's a lot of alternatives, and so an alternative would be, you imagine that there's a new scalar field in town, 1/2 phi dot squared. Its energy is 1/2 phi dot squared plus V. Its pressure is 1/2 phi dot squared minus V, let's say. And then you design V such that, you know, V is much bigger than phi dot squared now. And then we know that that's going to look like, if phi dot is 0, this is a cosmological constant, and it's like a vacuum energy. But if it's not 0, it could be time dependent. So if phi dot is not 0, W might be, P over rho might be time dependent. And so that suggests you're interested in testing these things. And so do they depend on time? And people do test those things because there are alternatives like this. But the main message I'm saying right now is that certainly there's no reason not to look at alternatives, but the evidence doesn't require them. It's not like those are solving a problem that you had with the observations. Right. So what's the problem? Why isn't dark energy a solved problem? The party line that you'll get is that dark energy is actually less of a solved problem than dark matter is. And that's because the problem with the vacuum energy is that people think that they have some sense as to how big it should be. So it's the size of the vacuum energy. It's smaller than expected. Believed to be reasonable. And so this is essentially a naturalness argument. So what I want to, the purpose of the next part of the classes is I want to flesh out, there's a series of steps. There's a naive way of saying this, which is naive, and then there's objections to the naive way of saying it. And so I want to take you to what the picture is as to why, what the arguments are as to why people think this is smaller than it should be, so you can assess them yourself and you decide whether or not you are convinced. Okay, so implicit in that is the story that you've got an unmeasured value, which I've probably erased already. So rho is 3 electron volts to the fourth power, basically. And all you're doing is you're taking the Hubble scale that we know, putting in the units, and then changing to fundamental units. And that's a scale that's very small compared to other scales that we know about in nature. And so the question we're really asking is, what's the vacuum energy that would be predicted given what we know about nature? And that's what your tutorial was about. So and so one of the reasons for doing this explicitly is that this is kind of the starter drug for doing loops. It's kind of the all the issues you see in loops you see here in kind of a cartoon form, and so all the moral messages of how you do loops in general, quantum corrections in general, in more complicated things and for other things, they all go like you see it here, and so it's a good example where you can be explicit about everything So the example for the tutorial, we took a Lagrangian, and I want to leave some space here. So let me write minus root g. I'm going to leave some space and write the thing that we actually tracked was d mu phi, d mu phi. And we took just a free particle. But what we could have equally well have done is we could have written down a potential energy here. And I've left space here because we could have actually had a constant here. We could have had a cosmological constant to start with if we wanted to. And so let's just write that. And V here, if we had been interested in being renormalizable, and I'll come back to how that shows up in this calculation in a second. You know, we could have written it as being 1/2 m squared phi squared, but we could have also imagined having lambda phi to the fourth, and you could have gone to town. Why not have, g over 6 factorial phi to the sixth, and so on. And so when you have interactions, the problem is always, what do you do with them? And so part of where we're headed for a lecture or two down the road the way people normally approach these calculations is within a semi-classical approximation, where you imagine that there's a big classical thing going on, where you would solve the classical field equations of the system. And in principle, we should include gravity in this, so we should, at some point we're going to have to add the minus 1 over 2 kappa squared r term and maybe other things. I guess what I'm doing there is I'm telling you my curvature convention. I don't know what your curvature conventions are, and at some point you have to choose them. But the two main choices are MTW conventions, which are Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler ones from the phone book that they wrote, and they would have had a plus sign here, and it's just to do with the definition of the Riemann tensor in terms of derivatives of the Christoffel symbols. Everybody pretty much agrees on what the Christoffel symbols should be defined as in terms of the metric. There's a choice of the metric signature, which we talked about, but MTW and most people who are doing relativity are using the same choice. So the issue here is that drives the choice of curvature conventions is the choice I'm making, the kinetic energy of every field is always the same sign. So in particular, the Einstein action has the same sign as the kinetic energy of a skitter does, and if we'd written the Maxwell action, it would have also had the minus sign. And that's the Weinberg choice. And then the disadvantage of that choice is that if you look at the curvature scalar for a sphere, it's negative. So the Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler choice is the one where you've the sign of the Riemann tensor is designed so that the curvature scalar for a two-sphere is positive. You know, that's very intuitive that it's supposed to be positive, very geometrical. But when you make that choice, then the sign here is the opposite to what it would have been for other kinetic energies for other fields. But this is one of those conventions where it doesn't really matter much, because the only real issue is an overall sign in the Riemann tensor, and that's fairly easy to track. The only reason to be aware that it's there is when you calculate the Riemann tensor in an application, you're using software. Very rarely are you actually calculating from scratch what the Riemann tensor is, and the software has chosen that convention, and you should be aware of what that convention is when you're using it. And be aware that everyone's not using the same conventions. So, all right. So that's the Weinberg convention. So now In the semi-classical picture, you know, you might have asked, why do I write a potential that's complicated and not have a more complicated kinetic term and other things? So I'm going to come back to that later on. And that's to do with what's justifying the semi-classical approximation. But I want to follow this potential in a little bit of detail because I'm keeping, we have a mass term, we have an interaction term, but I've kept what would be called a non-renormalizable interaction. And I, in our calculation of the vacuum energy, I just want to show you that there's a, adding this term gives you issues that are not there if you had only these two terms. And that's kind of, I'm just going to use this to illustrate the point. But the way we're going to approach this is we're going to imagine that we have some classical solution to the classical equations for that system. And I'm going to take a static solution where we just imagine that the metric is just some static thing and the scalar field just sits at the minimum of its potential. And then, so that'll be our classical solution. And then we imagine that looking at fluctuations around it. So let's say delta phi. Let me actually, let's do that. And in principle, we should do the same thing for the metric. So we would have g mu nu is some background g mu nu, call it bar plus fluctuations. And that's trickier because the metric is transforming under symmetries in a particular way, and that kind of a split will be more delicate. So we'll come back to that later on. I'm going to focus on the scalar part of it because that's the easy thing that that you will have seen. And what you're, in a semi-classical approximation, what you're doing is you're doing an expansion in powers of these guys. So what will happen is that if you're, and you take your action, there'll be a thing that depends only in the background fields. Then there'll be something linear. But that linear term, when you expand the action, is going to vanish because that's what the classical field equations say. So if these guys satisfy the classical field equations, there'll be no linear piece when you expand the action because the field equations are the statement that the derivative of the action is zero. There'll be a second order piece or a quadratic piece in these fluctuations, which will be the free fluctuations. And then there'll be things involving more than quadratic powers coming from things expanding this thing out. There'll be delta phi cubes, and there'll be delta metrics to some power. And those are the interactions. And so you're imagining writing the action as being it's a classical piece phi plus a quadratic piece plus a cubic piece and so on. Where this is counting the powers of the deltas. And there's no linear piece because we're expanding around a classical background. So the classical approximation would be when you stop here. The keeping this term is what you would mean by that. This is, you'll see this is what was called the one loop approximation. So it's the first quantum correction. And then these things, including these things, to some order would be the higher loops. And so a central question will be, when you write something like this down, just writing down a series in some perturbations like this is nice, but it doesn't really tell you that the, in principle, the size of these things you're going to be able to, you should be able to calculate. And there should be some parameter in your problem which is controlling the validity of the classical approximation and whether or not this is a good approximation to neglect terms in this series. And so a central question will be, what's the small thing that controls this approximation? So we're going to come back to. So for later is what small parameter justifies stopping or truncating at some point? In practice, almost anything you see being done, particularly in cosmology, is stopping here. And then a few things go to here, and then very rarely do you see something going past here. And so implicit in that kind of a calculation is that you imagine there's something which is controlling everything. And I'm going to come back to the question of what that is. Because it can be quantified in a regime where of interest to applications like inflation or modern things, whenever there's some sort of, whenever you're in a very low curvature regime, which in practice you are in most applications, there's a there's an answer to that question, and it's a good one in the sense that it's something which gives you confidence that the classical approximation, for instance, in the solar system should be really good. But I'm going to put that aside for now, and I'm just going to take this theory, and if we had stopped here and asked what's the cosmological constant, so let's imagine a specific solution. So let's consider static solution as a special case. So we'll take phi to be one for which v prime of phi is 0. And then we'll take our metric to be time independent. So we'll take ds squared, which I mean g bar mu, dx nu, and we'll imagine it's minus dt squared plus g bar ij dxi dxj, where this has no t dependence. So I'm just taking some static metric. That's a general enough thing for what we want to do. In that case, you know, we've got time translation invariance. We should have a conserved energy, and so you know, making a Hamiltonian should make sense. And so if we expand around a solution like this in that program, then the we can ask kind of what the energy of the vacuum would be. And at the classical level, it's going to turn out to be this, that the classical energy of the vacuum. So the calculation you did in the tutorial, and then I'm about to repeat more schematically than you did, the upshot of it is that the classical energy density is lambda. And then once you include S2, there are quantum corrections. And our goal is to calculate the size of them. OK, so let's go. So if the program is we do this expansion, and we're going to stop here, so we're going to do the leading quantum corrections to the extent that we know there's a small thing controlling everything, then this is quadratic. And in practice, what that's going to mean is I'm going to take this potential, and I'm going to expand it around the minimum. And I'm not going to assume that the minimum is phi equals 0. This could have been a Mexican hat. This could have been negative, say. We can imagine that V prime is minimized when phi is not 0. And so so what we'll do is we'll take V to be, it's going to be, you know, V of phi naught. There'll be a linear term, which is going to vanish because of this condition. And then there'll be a 1/2 V prime prime of phi delta phi squared plus higher terms. And I can drop those if I'm only interested in S2. And so this is the thing which in the calculation that you did in the tutorial, you could imagine it being m squared of phi. If I compare it to that explicit potential, m squared of, these are derivatives of v with respect to phi. That's just the thing we had in the Lagrangian here, m squared. But there's also contributions from the interactions, which will have 1/2 lambda phi squared. And there'll be a 1 over 4 factorial g phi to the fourth, and so on, if we have more terms than potential. So we can imagine that m is really tracking phi, if we want to. OK, so now what we'd like to do is do what's in the tutorial. So we want to, we're interested in calculating the energy. We'd like to know what the vacuum, so we want the vacuum energy. First question is, what's the vacuum? You know, the vacuum energy, since we're working at the level where we're keeping, what we should be thinking is that this is a classical background, but the real problem, these fields were quantum fields. And so in practice, if you think of these things, hats being, making them operators, the hat lives there, effectively. So we're imagining that we've got the way to think about these operators is to think of them as being, describing the quantum fluctuations around some classical background. And so it's in this expression for the action, the quadratic action, where we have two delta phis, let's say, which is what I'm going to focus on, you should be thinking of those things as being operators. And so that's what the tutorial was doing. And so the question of what the vacuum energy then is that you say, well, I take the Hamiltonian, I calculate it as an operator, I find the, identify the state with the minimum energy. That's what I'll mean by the vacuum. And that's the energy that I should be calculating for the purposes of this comparison to cosmology, because that's the thing, which is the thing, the state. For the examples we're looking at, the vacuum has two equivalent definitions that need two ways of thinking about the vacuum that need not be the same, but which in this example will be the same. One of them is it's the state with the minimum energy. The other one is it's the state with no particles in it. And so so what we have to do is identify the minimum energy state. If those two definitions disagree, the minimum energy state is what you mean by the vacuum. Yeah?
Sorry, in this model, what is the field phi supposed to represent physically? Scalar particle?
It's just some scalar particle, yeah. But think of it as being, if you want, the Higgs field or something, but it's just some scalar particle, and I'm just, but what I'm really thinking is that every particle that we know about in nature has a field that goes with it, and in principle, this argument I'm making, I could have made for every particle that in the standard model, say. But if you want, just think of this as being, scalars are easy to do, think of this as being the Higgs field in the standard model, if you want something concrete to think about.
So is the lambda in the vacuum energy term in Lagrangian the same lambda as?
Ah, no, it's not. Thank you for asking. Yeah, this is the principle that you always use the same variable for everything, so let's call that rho naught. Just because it's like a vacuum, it'll play the role of an energy density. Thank you. So then here I wanted to say rho naught. I think that's the only place I use those. Yeah, so I'm just going through the exercise of how you calculate the vacuum energy for a random field. And in quantum field theory, every particle we know about is described by a field. And so this calculation goes through essentially for any particle we could have asked about, to the extent that you believe the semi-classical approximation. Minimum energy state, let's finish the sentence here. Then what we should do is we should calculate its energy eigenvalue. H on that state, I'll call it 0. It'll be something. And what we want is that'll be the vacuum energy. So just quantum mechanics, the way you know and love it. So you go through the exercise. So in this particular example, our S2, let me stop calling. I don't want to carry deltas around all the time. So maybe what I should do is I'll call, let me call the original field capital phi, and the correction I'll just call phi. So let's put in capital phi's everywhere. And here we would have, this is capital phi. And then this now becomes phi. All right, good. So that means if I want to write S2 out, what I'm just doing is I'm just taking that action, running it to quadratic order, and this is the one that you started off.
The n squared of phi should be n squared of capital phi.
Sorry?
The n squared of phi should be n squared of capital phi.
Well, no, because now this is where I've expanded. Curly phi is the background thing. And so what I'm doing is I've expanded things out, and I'm just giving I could have written V of capital phi here, but I'm just expanding. This is a Taylor expansion. All right, so S2 is going to be, I should be writing a G bar, but I'm going to stop writing that too because it's going to get old. So 1/2 d mu phi d mu phi, and there's a metric hidden in there, plus 1/2 m squared, and I won't write it very often anymore, but that m squared, think of it as being this whole function of phi, m psi squared. And so it's a quantum problem. These are all operators. The action is quadratic in the operators. This is not the action, I guess. This is the Lagrangian. The Lagrangian density is quadratic in the operators. That's a sign that it's a harmonic oscillator. So because it's quadratic, there's many ways to solve this problem. The two ways in the tutorial that you solve it is if you're happier with the path integral way of thinking about things, and what you would have done is you would have put this into some path integral, and I'll come back to that later on. Or you would have, if you're doing things canonically, you would have said, well, these are just operators. I calculate the Hamiltonian, so I calculate the canonical momentum to be the delta action, delta phi dot. That turns out to be root g phi dot. where dot is ddt. And then I calculate the Hamiltonian density as being pi times phi dot minus L. And then the Hamiltonian will just be the integral of that over all space. And so then that's the thing whose eigenstates I want to have. The problem is you want to diagonalize things. If you think of phi of x being the variable, where different x's are different operators, the problem here is that you're mixing up different x's. It's kind of local Lagrangian, but the derivatives kind of involve comparisons of positions that are at neighboring points, infinitesimally close. So you need to diagonalize it, and that's where going to, in flat space, you would have gone to Fourier modes, but what you're really trying to do is you're just trying to diagonalize. If I write the Hamiltonian density out, it was, if I do the definitions, what you did in the exercise was you saw that this was plus Gij So if we can choose eigenstates of this, then we're basically going to be in business. And we can always, because we've made the thing static, we're always free to Fourier transform. Another way of saying that is that that operator here, because we chose things to be static, doesn't depend on time, and so it commutes with ddt. So we're allowed to simultaneously diagonalize those two operators. So ddt, we can choose iddt of the mode functions to have some eigenvalue. And we can also choose this thing to have some eigenvalue. And I'm going to choose it to, with a minus sign because so what I'm doing is I guess I should have written the equations of motion before I actually, I'm one step ahead of myself here. So the field equation for phi is box phi minus box phi plus m squared phi equals 0. And so what I'd like to do to diagonalize the Hamiltonian is I want to write phi as the sum over some mode functions, an un of x, phi depends on x, space time, plus a star n un star of x. The field equation tells me that these u's should satisfy minus box plus m squared of the u's are 0. But what I'll do is I'll choose them in particular to satisfy minus gij grad I grad j un is omega squared un. And I'll choose them to satisfy dt u is equal to energy u. And I'm running this as a square because this is a this kind of an operator, because the metric is positive definite, this operator is a positive definite. You know, this operator with a minus sign is negative definite, because if you took something like, if I take any function, if I take minus g ij grad I grad j times any function f, and I multiply here by f, and I integrate over space, so I have to take the minus sign out, d3x, then I can integrate by parts and write that as being plus the integral of gij grad f d3x, and that's positive. Because this is something which is the, you know, it's a vector summed into a positive definite matrix. And so the fact that that's positive is what tells you that this thing with a minus sign has a positive spectrum, and that's why I'm writing it as a square of something. All right, so these two things together, when you put them in here, tell you they tell you that that epsilon squared has to be omega n squared plus m squared. That's what this tells you. So now you turn the crank. You've got these mode functions. You've got an expansion for phi in terms of these a's and a daggers, and you're making that expansion because in the hopes that if you plug this with that into that into that, it'll just become something which is, you know how to diagonalize it, right? And that's the, and then this is the usual thing that you see that because it's a harmonic oscillator, the harmonic oscillator algebra for the a's and a stars is equivalent to the canonical quantization commutator relations for phi. because you would have required the canonical momentum with phi to be to commute to be give you I or minus I times the delta function. And so this exercise shows you that if you normalize the modes correctly, and the notes are going to show you how to do that, then canonical quantization, which says that pi of x, phi of y, should be minus I delta of x, y, and phi of x and phi of y should have been 0, and so on. That's equivalent to the statement that a n a m star is equal to delta n m, and a n a m is 0. So you go through the exercise, and you see that so now if you plug all those things together, h is the sum over n of 1 half of the epsilon n over 2 times a n star a n plus a n a n star. And then the amazing statement is that you can trade this one for this one using the commutation relations, and so that just becomes a constant plus sum over n of epsilon n a star a. So that's our kind of final form. And it's just all algebra from there on in. And the useful thing is that you know that the commutation relations tell you that the eigenstates, things that will be the energy eigenstates, are states that are obtained from the ground state, which is annihilated by all the all these A's. Psi is always going to be product of over all the n's of a n star to some integer times that, and then it'll be there's some normalization that I'm not doing right here, and then the energy eigenstate, so e psi for such a state is just e naught plus the sum over n of these n's times epsilon n. So that's the interpretation is that. The reason that harmonic oscillators are everywhere is that free particles are harmonic oscillators. They're defined essentially by this criterion that their energy levels are evenly spaced. For harmonic oscillator, you know that that's true. For particles, that should also be true. If they're not interacting, the energy of adding one particle and adding two particles and adding three particles will always just be multiples of one another. And so that's why harmonic oscillators and particles are the same algebra. And so this shows you that this state here is the one with the minimum energy. It's the one that satisfies that. And then every time I act with something, I get a particle, and then I get the energy. That shows you that this E is the energy per particle. And then these N's are counting the number of particles, and then those are, you show that those in the tutorial, you show that those have the eigenvalue 0, 1, 2, and 3. So they're non-negative integers. So I guess I want to raise the board. So what? So we're going back to the question. We wanted to ask the question. We're heading towards the question, how do you calculate the vacuum energy? And this is kind of just following our nose. We had a system. If we're working in this semi-classical approximation where we're imagining expanding around a classical background, then we have some quadratic action as the leading quantum piece. If we stop at that piece, then the action will be quadratic. So the field equations will be linear. And that linear quantum system in a given background is essentially equivalent to the one loop approximation. So it's a free quantum field in some sort of a classical background. We can calculate the Hamiltonian, follow our nose like you would have done in flat space. And as long as you choose your modes in a way which kind of diagonalizes your evolution operator, then when you're finished, your Hamiltonian has this form that you know and love. And it's the one that gives you the particle mass, the particle energies, plus it also gives you the energy of the ground state. And normally, if you're not doing gravity, everyone just ignores the energy of the ground state. Because if you're not doing gravity, you're always looking at energy differences, and the energy of the ground state is always canceling. But for gravity, which we're interested in, that's there. So you really have to take it seriously, and you have to decide what it means. So in principle, it's observable. If the energy has vacuum, the vacuum has energy, sorry, because that's what the dark energy story told you, is that if you had a vacuum energy and it was Lorentz invariant, then you not only would it be observable, you would have observed it. So now we have to kind of deal with what that E is. And of course, the problem with, so what we've learned is that the vacuum energy at the quantum level, I did what I was not going to do. What I intended to do, so what I wrote here was what you did in the tutorial, but I made a point of writing in the action that rho naught term. And then what I intended to do when I did this in class was to track that rho naught term everywhere, and I forgot to. So all that happens is that it goes, it's something which doesn't really depend on the phis. It goes along for the ride. So at this point here, I should have really written plus rho naught. And so then we just track it through, and it, because it's in here, it shows up in H. This rho naught is inside the bracket, so there's a minus rho naught, so it'll show up as a plus rho naught in H. So if I go up to the Hamiltonian here, what I should have written was a plus, I think I forgot the root G here too, right? Nothing, none of this changes because this is not affecting the classical equations of motion for phi, but it comes in here now. So we would have had this plus the contribution of this rho naught to the energy, which is, so this sum is here, then I should have also had the integral d3x of rho naught. And so E naught, which I haven't written down for you yet, good. The only change is that E naught sees that rho naught at the end, at the quantum level. So the leading, so including the leading quantum effects is E naught is, it's the first, this is actually the classical term, d3x of rho naught times root g. And then there's this sum over n of 1 half epsilon n. And so this is what would have been there classically. If I had just asked what's the classical energy given that Lagrangian and keeping that rho naught term, the rho naught term would have just gone along for the ride as being an energy density. And so it would have given me this. And then this is, a better way to say that would be, since we're, the way you see the energy of the vacuum is you gravitate. So if I took the stress energy of the system at the classical level, the stress energy of the rho naught term would have just been something proportional to g mu nu. And so it's giving me a piece in the energy density, which goes like rho naught. That's what this says. And then this stuff is the correction that we're getting because we went past the classical term and we included the fluctuations. So this rho naught, you know, the way you should think about the rho naught is that rho naught was that word there. The first term, the classical approximation, I'm supposed to take the action and think of it as depending on the background fields. If my potential had been this potential here, the action evaluated at curly phi, the background thing, is rho naught. So I should be thinking of rho naught is really V of phi. If I had had a background for which the gradients of phi were not zero, then they would have contributed to the energy too, but I chose a static background. And so the only place in the action that was surviving when I took a non-zero, when I evaluated a static V, was this one. And I'm ignoring for this part the metric part of things, because I'm just trying to track the energy in this scalar sector. So this, the fact that this rho naught is there is not a surprise. I've made it look like a surprise because I've backed into it in the way I presented it to you. But my intention had been that rho naught was there. It was the potential energy evaluated at the background, and that was the first term up there. And I should have just kept it along for the ride. And if I had done, I would have gotten this term. And then the quantum thing we've just calculated is this term. And so in the spirit that we have classical plus quantum correction plus corrections to the corrections, this would have been the classical term. This would have been the quantum term. And then if we had interactions, we could have seen what they did.
So if you identify rho naught as V5,
yeah,
as a classical field, then we should not have written rho naught in the bunch, right? Because it would just have come out of the V5, right? V capital 5.
It depends. So if it depends what the rules are. So if you're, so at this point, I guess I should not have written it because that was L2. But if I'd written, so that what I should have really written here was L is L0 plus L2, and that would have been minus root g v of phi plus L2.
And v of phi.
And that's L2. Right, and so then this is what I've been calling rho naught. So that's what I should have been doing. And I apologize for not for reintroducing it at the end of the day. But then you just now track it all through, and then it's still here. And I'm flogging it because it's going to play an important role. And the basic problem, as you know, is that this is diverging. And it's diverging, you know, in all possible ways. It's diverging from the point of view that if n, where n gets large, it's diverging. There's a sense in which it's diverging at very long distance. So n large, you know, if you want to think concretely about what n is, let's imagine that the example of flat space you saw already in the tutorial, but you could imagine that our space-time is a three-sphere together with time or something. So then these are the spherical harmonics for a three-sphere. So it's something which is a very concrete sum. But the n's kind of, in that case, if we had a 2 plus 1 dimensional space-time, it would have been a two-sphere. And then you know that these n's would have been the harmonic, spherical harmonic L's and M's. And they run from 0 to infinity. And so those sums are diverging. Because in that case, if we had a two-sphere, this omega squared eigenvalue, which I hopefully haven't erased, yeah, this one. If we'd been doing a two-sphere, this would have been del squared on a two-sphere, and this would have been L, L plus 1, essentially. So you know that this is going like quadratically with L for large L, and you're essentially trying to do a sum over L of the square root of L squared L plus 1. So that's, you're doing a sum which is diverging for large L. Large L is small angles, and so that's like in, if we had been doing a, in flat space, this would have been an integral over momenta, and this would have been the square root of P squared plus M squared. And so for large p, this is also diverging. And large p is, again, small distances. So this divergence is, so there's in the what they call the uv. This is a small distances. But this thing is also diverging, although more subtly, in the ir. This is at large distances. And in that sense, it's a poster child for divergences, right? Divergences come to you in two ways. They come to you because there's a divergence coming from long distances or small distances. And what happens here is the moral everywhere. So the way I learned it in quantum field theory is, as a student, what we were told is that quantum field theory is like a Middle Eastern religion. It's something which is, it's cruel, but fair. And so as long as you're faithful to it, you know, then you will be rewarded. But if you stray from it, it will smite you. And so divergences are it smiting you, because it's telling you that you did something wrong. And so what you are doing wrong here is different in these two cases. And that's the main message, is that the infrared divergences, it really is smiting you. Because what the infrared divergence is telling you is that you asked the wrong question. You ask for something which really isn't physical, and because of that, you've got a stupid answer. So the message, what always happens here is, this means you've asked the wrong question. So that means you should go back and think about why it happened, because there's something wrong in the way you're reasoning about things. So it's not a physical thing you've asked. This is normally something which is the very short distance physics. You know, we don't claim to understand everything in nature. We don't think we understand what's going on at all possible scales. I mean, some people in this building do. They think they know what's going on in the Planck scale, and they may be right. But in general, when you're calculating things at long distances, you know, nature allows you to understand long distances on their own terms and not have to know about what's going on at all scales. And so if you're seeing something which is diverging, and it's diverging because it really depends on what's going on at small scales, that's something you should be able to absorb into your ignorance of what's going on at small scales. And so this is something which is, long scales you think you understand because they're big and you can look at them, but small ones you have no idea what they are yet until you can make a microscope that's good enough. So this is something which is should be absorbable into our ignorance of small scales.
So higher divergence comes from the volume.
It's not. I'll show it to you in a second. In the tutorial, you were getting deltas of zeros, and in the flat space case where you had translation invariance, that was a volume of space-time divergence. But it's also happening here in the time direction. So that's the one I'm trying to focus on here. That's a long time thing. So it's so those are the ones that are saying here. So the short version of it in the tutorial is that the IR divergences I have in mind here are the ones that are to do with things diverging with the length of time that you look at things, or they're diverging with the volume of space-time. And what they're really saying is that if you really live in an infinitely big space and it's a homogeneous space, you should have expected that the energy is going to either be zero or infinite, because if there's any non-zero energy density and you integrate it over an infinite volume of space, you're going to get an infinite answer. So this thing, the IR part of the divergence is saying that if you really have an infinitely large space and it's true that energy is distributed across that space, you should expect the energy to be diverging because it should go like the volume of the space. The thing that you should have been calculating was the energy density. And of course, that's what gravitates. That's the thing, the cosmological constant was the thing that was gravitating, not the energy. So in our case, the message will be that our IR divergences were the factors of 2 pi delta of 0, where that was energy equals 0 of the tutorial. And also, the same thing was happening in flat space. If you had translation invariant spaces, so not just flat space, any homogeneous space where you have an infinite volume, you'll get a similar kind of a thing, which will be the divergence with the volume, it'll be the proportion of the volume of the space. But in flat space, that came to us as this delta of p equals 0. So this was the thing that was proportional to basically the integral dt. If we had, this would have been e to the I et, but because e was 0, this is 1, and so we're really getting just the, if this is going from minus t to t, this is something which is proportional to t. And the same thing for in the space, 2 pi cubed delta cubed of p would have been the integral d3x of e to the I p dot x. But if this is 0 because p is 0, then we're just getting the volume of space. So in our example, what our infrared divergences are really telling us that what we should be calculating is not, you saw this one, not the way I'm calculating it now. You saw this one when you did the space-time version of the calculation. But in our example, if you'd done it in flat space, you would have seen in this sum would have been an integral over d3p, but it would have also come with a factor of delta of 0. And that delta of 0 is saying that this whole thing is proportional to the volume. What you should be calculating is this divided by the volume, and that will be the thing that no longer has an infrared divergence. So.
Minor point, but shouldn't the integral be from minus t by 2 to t by 2?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So the short version of the IR part of it, so in our case, if we calculate the energy density, which is the limit, say, as the volume goes to infinity of the energy divided by v, this is finite as v goes to infinity. So the thing that we were doing wrong here when we find that E naught is diverging at large volumes was that no one's measuring the energy of the vacuum. What they're measuring is the energy density of the vacuum when you ask how it's gravitating. So this is also the observable. There are situations where E naught might be observable. Supposing you have extra dimensions or something, and they have some shape, and you're interested in the total energy of those extra dimensions, they'll have a finite volume, and then that won't diverge, and then you'll get an answer which can play a role in something you're doing. But the IR divergences are just basically punishing you for asking a question, and if whenever you get one, you go back and ask, so what did I ask that was really not physical? And that normally tells you how to deal with it. And then the UV one, this is the renormalization program. So the statement that you can hide what's going on into the physics of small distances is the statement of renormalization, because in the renormalization program, all the constants that you think that you have in your Lagrangian and you did not predict, like lambda or g or mass, those are things that in principle, if someone had given you a more fundamental theory, you would have been able to predict. But right now, you're just taking them as being parameters that came to you from the more fundamental theory. And so they are parameterizing your ignorance of the more fundamental theory. And so those are the things in which you can hide these ultraviolet divergences. So, so the absorption is what we mean by renormalization. And that carries a message with it because it means that the divergences are normally appearing every way that short distance physics could have appeared, because it's really, you don't know what's going on at short distances. If you're seeing you're sensitive to things, then if you get a divergence that's at short distances, that means there is an interaction that you could have had which would have seen that, that would have expressed that physics that you could have had at short distances that you're seeing a divergence from. So if you find that you're doing a calculation and there are no parameters in which you can absorb the parameter that you, the divergence that you're finding, it just means that you were not sufficiently broad-minded in what your parameters were. And you should be rethinking what your set of parameters are that are allowed, because the theory is telling you that short distance physics is allowed to affect what you're calculating at the level that you're calculating it. And so you need to deal with that. And that's why I'm, so in the example, the reason I want to keep this term, the G term as well as the phi squared term, is that illustrates kind of what goes on there. So let me cut to the chase because we're done here. So let me. And what do I want to do here? I'll erase that. So for example, in that flat space example, where you work out the, in the tutorial, you worked out the vacuum energy. In flat space, the tutorial found that the vacuum energy was, you know, that was E naught over V. And that was, the classical part of it was just, you know, V of phi. Then the quantum part of it was the thing that came from doing all these integrals. And remember, that was the thing that turned out to be m to the fourth over 64 pi squared log of m squared over mu squared. And then there was things that you couldn't predict. And when you think of them as being functions of m, that's less informative. But let's think of them as being functions of phi, which we can do because m squared is really in secret a function of phi. So let's think of this as being, in the same way that the classical contribution to the vacuum energy was the potential energy as a function of phi, we can think of this as being the quantum correction to the potential energy as a function of phi. So this is like V quantum of phi. And the way we find it is that we put in the phi dependence that we know is hidden in m. So what do we have here? So we know that m squared, I just transcribed that, it was a constant, plus 1 half lambda phi squared plus 1 4 factorial g phi to the fourth. So m to the fourth is going to be that squared. So it'll be m to the fourth, and then it'll be a, so let me first square out these terms. So it's going to be lambda m squared phi squared, and then we'll have lambda squared over 4 phi to the fourth. So those are all the ones that would be there if g had been 0. And then once we have non-zero g, then we get also another phi to the fourth term. So we get plus 1 over 4 times 3 times 2 is 12 gm squared phi squared phi to the fourth. And then there's a phi to the sixth term and a phi to the eighth term. So if we if g had been 0, then this would have been, m squared would have been something, a quadratic function of phi, because we had just those two terms. And this would have been a quartic function of phi, so it would have been this, this, and this. But this would have been something, and so that means that these terms were exactly the terms that were already in your Lagrangian, because if g is 0, then m to the fourth is quartic, and m squared is quadratic. In phi. And so these coefficients, we didn't know how to calculate them. In the calculation, what we did is we differentiated, picked m a number of times until things were finite, and then we integrated again. And that emphasized that they were just arbitrary. And the different ways of regulating those integrals would have given us different values for these A, Bs, and Cs. So all the divergences that we would have had in the ultraviolet are hidden in A, B, and C. But because if G is 0, they're all quartic in phi, that means that we can always absorb them into the things that we had in our potential to start with, wherever that is. So the potential is there. So the potential has a quadratic piece and a quartic piece. And if G is 0, that's it. So that means that anything that's quartic or less in phi can be absorbed into. So you can always absorb A, B, and C into lambda m squared or v of phi, or the constant piece in v. I didn't write it, but it would be like v naught, if you like. So the things that were diverging were exactly also the things you had in your Lagrangian. And so that's why people will tell you that the if you want your theory to be renormalizable, you should be taking a potential in four dimensions, which is quartic and phi and no more. And that's because when you get these divergences, and this is kind of an example, but it's not the only example, that if you had kept only those terms up to quartic order, the things that are diverging are also of quartic order, and so you've always got a parameter to absorb them into. But if you had kept the G term, then all bets are off, because we kept the G term, we have a new term in the Lagrangian, we have a sixth power of phi in the Lagrangian, but we've got a divergence here, which was happening at phi to the eighth, which we don't have a parameter for. And so that's the sign of a non-renormalizable theory, that if you have, you're getting divergences that were not already there in your Lagrangian, and so that's telling you that you are asking a question where you should have probably, if you're going to include the phi to the sixth term, you really should also include the phi to the eighth term, and also the phi to the tenth term, and also the phi to the whatever term. Because the theory is telling you that if you don't include them, you're asking a question that's sensitive enough to the small distance physics that they could have been there, and you should have included them because you needed them to absorb the sensitivity you have to small distance physics. So the main thing, since I got to stop, that we'll pick up next time is that difference between renormalizable and non-renormalizable is a central one in this part of the problem. And the rule of thumb, in fact, the definition of renormalizable, as far as you're concerned, is the way you tell the difference between a renormalizable and a non-renormalizable interaction is that the coupling constants in all the renormalizable terms have dimensions in fundamental units that are non-negative powers of mass. So if you think of the dimensions of phi has dimensions of mass because the Lagrangian had to be a dimensions of mass. The action is always dimensionless because it's got the same dimensions as h bar, and that's 1. So Lagrangian is the integrated, d4x of the Lagrangian is dimensionless. So the Lagrangian has to have dimensions of 1 over length to the fourth. So that's mass to the fourth. The kinetic term, the derivatives are mass squared. So that means the phis have to each be masses. And so that means the dimensions of a phi are mass. And in the potential, that means that the coefficient of phi squared is a mass squared. That's good, because it was a mass squared. The coefficient of phi to the fourth is dimensionless. That was lambda. But the coefficient of phi to the sixth was 1 over mass squared. So g, the sign of it being not renormalizable was it went like 1 over mass squared. And that's why that's a problem, because once you have a 1 over mass squared, then the divergences are typically large mass scales to some positive power. And if you have a coupling with negative powers of a mass and dimension, then you can make arbitrary. If you have enough powers of the coupling constant, you can have as many divergences as you like. And there's nothing that tells you where to stop things. Once you have anything with negative dimensions and powers of mass, you should have to have pretty much everything with negative powers of mass.
What about the logarithmic term?
So the log term is something which was not polluted by these arguments, right? So that this coefficient is something which you got to predict. And the uncertainty of adding polynomials to the Lagrangian would not have stopped you predicting it. So then the question becomes, why couldn't I write down non-analytic functions in my Lagrangian? And that's to do with the cleanest statement is the Folk theorem, right? That it's normally the things become non-analytic in parameters when something physical you try to ignore something physical. It's, again, it's a theory punishing you for something. So maybe I should come back to that next time, because it's kind of a topic in itself. But the upshot is that typically these logarithms, because you're looking at polynomials and fields and derivatives, these logarithms are predictions, and those are the things that you did get to give an absolute statement for. And so amongst all the things you could have asked, those are the ones that are informative, and these are the ones that are less informative, because they depend on the exact value of these couplings, which you didn't know anyway.
Is the upshot of this whole discussion that the vacuum energy they calculate is much larger than observed?
That's where the nationalist press problem will be. Thank you for asking that question. Okay. I don't know this man. So there he is. It wasn't a plant at all. So that was the punchline. So the punchline was, so if you go back to, I kind of got off on this renormalizable story, which is also an interesting story, and we're going to go back to that. But for the dark energy, the statement is that these contributions are enormous because they're, and how enormous they are depends on which things you think are important. So if you think of these things as being divergent coefficients, so if I take a phi squared times something, it'll be some cutoff squared. That's really big because that's some scale that's at very high energies. But even this is already enormous because all the masses in the problem that you know about in the standard model are huge compared to 10 to minus 3 electron volts. So even if you said that those are going to be absorbed into things that I don't understand, this one is enormous. And so the naturalist question is that everything you get out of these calculations in the regime that you can calculate things, when things are weakly coupled, which is true for the standard model at high energies, then you get things that are much bigger than you measure. And the objection to that is that, well, so what? Because it's always true that whatever I calculate here, no matter how big it is, I've got another parameter that I didn't know what it was either. The constant piece of the potential, you know, that piece here, the D or the C or whatever it was, that was a constant piece of the potential. It was just going along for the ride. That was a parameter in the Lagrangian, which was the cosmological constant, basically. It was one of these unknown things that I didn't know what it was. And so why can't I absorb any big thing here into that and just say, by measuring the vacuum energy, I've measured the value of this parameter. What counts is the renormalized parameter. Once I've absorbed the divergences into this thing here and got a renormalized quantity, that's just some unknown parameter which I learned by comparing it to the measurement. So what's the problem? And so the naturalist problem I want to take you to is our understanding of how renormalization works says that that's a problem. But to tell you why it's a problem, I need to tell you more about renormalization. That's kind of where we're going.
Well, sometimes we, so if you added another field to your model,
yeah,
had anti-commuting statistics.
Yep.
And you followed this same.
It would have been the opposite sign.
Yeah. And so if you had both fields, maybe you could cancel them. The vacuum energy of both fields.
That's the supersymmetry argument. So if you kind of see what's happening. That the fermion. So you're right that if at the point where we went from A star A plus A A star to the A star A, the sign would have been different for fermions. And that's how you see that they're kind of contributing in a negative way. Hi, Kendrick. I'm just about done. But for them to cancel, they have to have the same mass, and all the couplings have to be the same. So to really make that cancellation work exactly, the fermions and the bosons have to have couplings that are related. Because, for example, here, this depended on m squared, and m squared depended on lambda and all these other couplings. And so if you did the same thing for fermions, you would have had a dependence on their couplings too. So for them to cancel, their couplings have to be related to the bosonic couplings. And that's what supersymmetry does for you. It gives you the relationship you need to make their cancellation perfect, but only if supersymmetry doesn't break. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the various symmetries you could use to do a better job on this later on, but that's a couple lectures down the road. But it's a way people take seriously because of that sign is an important sign.
Well, I don't see why the coupling has to be the same. You would just cancel the sum over the modes, right?
Well, just start with the mass, right? If the mass runs in the same, then you'd expect them not to cancel, right? Because the whole answer is a function of mass times the cutoff. And now you can argue what you do with the cutoff, but once you've renormalized the cutoff, in the end of the day, the thing depends on the mass because it has dimensions. And so if the masses were different, then why would they cancel? You'd have, you know, m1 to the fourth minus some different m2 to the fourth, but their difference isn't zero.
Well, but I mean, in the universe, you have more than two particles, right?
So you might arrange them all to just kind of conspire.
Yeah, yeah.
But then to get that to work, and including the, you know, so we only done the first term, you want to do all the other interactions. So you have to then start asking, do the corrections ruin your cancellation? And that leads you to supersymmetry, that the thing you need to get the conspiracy to work to all orders normally requires a symmetry, and supersymmetry will do that for you. It doesn't mean that's the only known way of doing it. And I don't know that there's a theorem that you couldn't do it some other way, but there's no known other way. There are other symmetries, but the sign symmetry that you're using is the one that supersymmetry is normally exploiting. But I'll say more about that when we get to that.
Okay.